Didn't do it now. Okay, so the topic was assigned a proper view of God. And I don't know if I reached a lot of earth-shattering views of God necessarily, but it was good for me to study up on the proper view of God. I used a couple different sources. One of the best sources was this book by Tozer called The Knowledge of the Holy. A lot of you probably read that, but it's printed way back in the ancient age of 1960, I think, was when he printed that. But the book is really, really filled with a lot of good knowledge about God that I just don't know if, there's books out there like that today, but I don't know if they cut right to the chase like Tozer does. I was really impressed. For some reason, I don't know if I'd ever read it before, and Nathan recommended it. So, we're not going to cover everything. I am going to read some directly out of his book a little bit later on. But the proper view of God. Personally, sometimes my view of God can be a bit clouded. Sometimes either from personal experiences or things going on around the world or things happening to other people or things happening to me. My view can sometimes be clouded. Sometimes he's so close yet so far away. And tonight I'm not trying to, say that everybody has, everybody I'm speaking to has the wrong view of God. That's not what I'm trying to do. But I'd like to compare it a little bit like when I'm out spraying roofs in the summertime. So it's usually fairly warm. Some years, like the last couple years, sometimes it's 105 degrees. And sweat just, rolls as I'm spraying. And I have sunglasses. I always wear sunglasses. And the sunglasses get sweat on them. And all of a sudden, I can't really see the roof anymore. And when I can't see the roof anymore, I usually spray for a little bit longer. But usually, I figure out that, hey, I really probably should be seeing what I'm doing here. So I try to find something and wipe the sunglasses off. Sometimes I need to go down to the trailer and get a cotton cloth and wipe the sunglasses off, and I have a clear view of the roof again. And I'm like, man, this is neat. I can actually see the roof again. So I'd like to compare that tonight about how our views can sometimes get a little bit cloudy, and sometimes we just need some little reminders from the Bible or from people about our view of God. Sometimes it needs just a little bit of cleaning up. And so I hope that we can and do some of that tonight. I want to do that for my life, and maybe some of you can do that in your personal life too. So in the first section, I would like to find out, of course, in the Bible, there's many people that had visions of God, and Moses seen the backside of God. He didn't actually see his face, but I'd like to look at Ezekiel. Let's see here. Ezekiel 1, verse 13. Actually, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here. Before we read that, I'm going to jump over and read chapter 1, verse 1. Hang on just a second while I read that. You don't have to turn to that. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. So it's just pointing out about where God originated from. And I also have another quote here by a man named Bill Bright. He says, "Everything about our lives, our attitudes, our motives, our desires, our actions, and even our words is influenced by our view of God." So think about that. I don't know if I, yeah, if I, well, I realized this, but it was a good reminder again that everything in my life, you know, my attitude, to my, the way I treat other people, to like the story we heard earlier tonight, how we treat other people, to whatever, is somewhat based on our view of God, how we view God. If that view isn't right with God, then or how we view God isn't right, then some of these things are not gonna, yeah, they're not good. Okay, let's turn to Ezekiel 1, verse 13, finally. So, Ezekiel was seeing a vision, and in the beginning he says that he saw a vision of God. And I'd like to start reading at verse 13. You might think this is some really, it's kind of strange reading, but we'll explain a little bit later. So the appearance of the living creatures was like the burning coals of fire, or like torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. And I looked at the living creatures. I saw a wheel on the ground beside each of the creatures and its four faces. It was an appearance and the structure of the wheels. They sparked like crystal light, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made of a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of four directions. The creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome. All four rims were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved, and when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When the creatures moved, they also moved. When the creatures stood still, they also stood still. When the creatures rose from the ground, the wheels rose along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Spread out above the heads of the living creatures was what looked like an expanse. In their wings were stretched out one toward another, and each of the two wings covering its bodies. When the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings like a roar of rushing waters, and the voice of the Almighty like tumult of an army. When they stood still, they lowered their wings. Then came a voice from above in the expanse of their heads, as they stood with their lowered wings above the expanse of their wings. Above the expanse of their heads was what looked like the throne of sapphire, and high above the throne was a figure, that of man. I saw from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like a glowing metal, and full of fire, that from and from there down he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him, like the appearance of a rainbow, and in the clouds on a rainy day it was a radiance in him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down and heard the voice of the one speaking. So, you know, the question is like, who is God? What is God like? It sounds like maybe children ask you what is God like, but it's good for us to kind of remember what is God like. And Tozer says, I must acknowledge that it cannot be answered except to say that God is not like anything. That is, he is not exactly like anything or anybody. So in other words, yeah. And then this is just to show that Ezekiel. Here, I'll just read what Tozer wrote. But when the Spirit would acquaint us with something that lies beyond our field of knowledge, he tells us that this is the thing is like something we already know, but is always careful to phrase his description so as to save us from slavish literalism. For example, when the prophet Ezekiel saw heaven open up and beheld the visions of God, he found himself looking at that which he had no language to describe. What he was seeing was wholly different from anything he had ever known before, so he fell back upon the language of resemblance. The nearer he approaches the burning throne, the less sure his words become. So here we have Ezekiel, seeing the glory of God, the glory of the Lord, and first time I read this, I was like, well, it's really weird. He can't even describe really what he's seeing, but I don't blame Ezekiel for that because it's the glory of the Lord. What do you guys have to say about the glory of the Lord, or how? Yeah, there's other parts in the Bible where people see the glory of the Lord. How do we see the? I mean, I don't think any of us in here has probably had this exact experience of seeing the Lord like this. But what are some ways that on earth that we can see the glory of the Lord? I'd like to hear from you. Not in this sense. It doesn't have to be in this sense. But how do we see the glory of the Lord? Yeah, go ahead, Ollie.
Also, how he transforms people to accept him, and how that he gets to follow him, how that people who love, even love others. It takes God to help us to love our enemies. And this is a transformation that takes place in our heart.
I think we see his glory in any deed.
Very good. Yeah, very good. Okay, go ahead, Dwight. Very good. Very good. I think we'll end that part there. So we'll turn to Joshua chapter 5, verse 13. Earlier in the chapter, in chapter 5 here, we see that, I'll just read verse 1. Now when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how much the Lord had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites, until we had crossed over, their hearts melted. They no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. So, and in this section, in verse 13, we're looking at the fall of Jericho. Actually, I'll just read read these couple verses and then we'll talk about them. So verse 13, now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, are you for us or are you for our enemies? Neither, he replied, but as a commander in the army of the Lord, I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? The commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place you are standing on is holy. You know, so earlier in the chapter, we see, you know, of course, the verse 1 I read about the Jordan being dry. You know, the people of Israel will probably, I'm getting some commentary from another writer, but he was pointing out that probably, you know, they were excited because the kings were afraid of them. Why not just go in and take it? You know, just boom, just go take it. The kings are afraid of, you know, they're afraid of us. They don't have any, they don't really want to fight us anymore or whatever. And probably, you know, Joshua was close to Jericho trying to scout out, you know, what he's up against. He was there scouting and, sometimes in life we're ready to get things going, ready to go pretty fast if we think that the way is clear. And imagine the Israelites felt like, you know, the way is clear. But of course, from verse 1, they did some other stuff, circumcision and that. And then here Joshua was out scouting, seen this man standing in front of him. And, you know, when you see a man in front of you with a sword, you know, it's to go against the foe defensively or offensively. And then, you know, a sword drawn is to, you know, either fight for us or fight for Israel. So one of the two. And so Joshua just asked him, are you for us or are you for our enemies? And you'd think that if, you know, you think that the proper response would have been, you know, I'm for you. I'm for you, Israel. I'm here for you. I'm fighting for you. Which, of course, that ended up happening then. But this man standing there said neither, but as the commander of the army of the Lord. And so some of the main key points here is that, you know, the first part is, you know, why didn't he say, I'm just here, you know, I'm here for you, Israel. But in essence, the man in the sword said neither. I'm not here to take sides, yours or anyone else's side, but I'm here, you know, I'm here as the commander of the Lord's army. So it's important to know that, yeah, to lay down these principles. The first principle is that, you know, Joshua to claim God's allegiance for his cause, no matter how right or how holy it might be. Rather, the need was for Joshua to acknowledge God's claim over Joshua for God's purpose. We tend to approach our battles and causes backwards. We turn things all around and try to marshal God to support us rather than to submit and follow him. So, it's kind of easy for us if we have a cause to go to God. And I think that's, you know, I think there's a, that's right. But like Joshua here, sometimes we got to realize that we're going with God. God's not just going, you know, God goes with us too. But sometimes in life, we go with God. We go where God wants us to go. And what he wants us to be, how we seek God's will for our lives. But as Joshua with all of us in the army of the king must be following the Lord, submitting to his authority and taking orders from him and resting the battle in his hands, because we realize it really is his battle as a supreme commander. There seems to be no question that Joshua understood this, as evidenced by the question, as when he asked, what has my Lord to say to his servant? Here he's asking the Lord for the orders, and that's surely when he received the directions for taking Jericho. So the proper view, you know, coming back to the proper view of God, is it, I mean, this is nothing against Joshua here. I don't think he did anything wrong necessarily, but it's just a human response. So do we always ask, you know, do we always, of course we know which side God's on, but when we come to God, do we ask what he would have for our life, or do we tell him first and then hope that he agrees and that he aligns to our life? What would you like to say about this? And I'm, you know, one of the things that I thought of my own life when I see about thinking about proper views of God is that, you know, the only way to really gauge on our view of God, not really to gauge, but ways to learn how to view God better is to look back on our life in circumstances where maybe we did not have the proper view of God, and we can take that and we can encourage other believers and ourselves if another crisis comes up in our life or whatever. So I'd like to hear a little bit from you about how we approach God with what we do with our life, and yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Very good. You know, and then when Joshua asked, what message does my Lord have for his servant? You know, he quickly, once he realized that God was speaking to him, he quickly, you know, his response was worship and submission immediately. There was no question in his mind. I don't think it took him a long time to do that. And that's, you know, that's probably pretty important when, you know, that's pretty important in the proper view of God that that we have this worship and submission of God. Probably not only in crisis situations or when God's directly speaking to us, but also in other, you know, also in everyday life. Yeah. Right. Very good. Go ahead.
Desire. We are
middle.
A big part of you, God makes God big and us small. And I think that Isaiah, he had that vision. Maybe a bit like Ezekiel here. I think he was just struck with how undone and how unclean and how insignificant he really was. In that posture then, with God's anointing, he would be used.
Yeah, that's true. I'm going to read a couple chapters, not chapters, but a couple paragraphs out of the book, the Tozer book, and this is on the self-sufficiency of God. To admit the existence of a need in God is to admit the incompleteness in the divine being. Need is a creature word and cannot be spoken of the Creator God. Has a relation to everything else he has made, but he has no necessary relation to anything outside himself. His interest in his creatures arises from his sovereign good pleasure, not from any need those creatures can supply, nor from any completeness they can bring him who is complete in himself. Again, we must reverse the familiar flow of our thoughts and try to understand that which is unique, that which stands alone as being true in this situation and nowhere else. Our common habits of thought allow for the existence of need among created things. Nothing is complete in itself, but requires something outside itself in order to exist. All breathing things need air. Every organism needs food or water. Take air and water from the earth, and all life will perish instantly. It may be stated as an axiom to stay alive, every created thing needs something other created things, and all things need God. To God alone, nothing is necessary. In Philippians 2:13, he says, "It is God which worketh in you." I think there's the worketh. Let me see here. Let me just turn to that just a second. Oh, it's this verse 12. "Therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed me, not only in my presence, but now more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose." But I'd like to hear a little bit about our view of God, kind of like Lowell was saying that, you know, it can make us feel small or inadequate or whatever, but I'd like to hear some discussion on if you have times in your life when you, or if there's ever been like a big crisis in your life and you figured out all of a sudden that maybe you didn't have the proper view of God. I don't know if that's fair to ask, but what I'm trying to get at is that, you know, everything's going well in our lives. We think we have a pretty good view of God. You know, we're getting along. Everything's going good, but when something happens, it kind of gauges, you know, really how do we view God. Sometimes we might get angry with God. Sometimes we might question God. What are some verses or what are some ways that in your Christian life that you think of that has helped you gain proper perspective in God? I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but go ahead, David. Yeah, go ahead, Ollie. Yeah, I had that in my notes too about, you know, that we're Isaiah 55 verses 8 through 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As in the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So yeah, it's, you know, I found this other quote that I really liked, or this other deal on that about, you know, sometimes things happen that we want to understand. We want to understand fully, but pursuing a true view of God, really knowing him, is not the same as understanding why he does or does not do something. God is very clear that his ways are higher than our ways, just the verse I read there. So we need to fight the temptation to reduce life to cause and effect. Good and bad circumstances aren't exclusively to teach us lessons. So, yeah, sometimes in life things happen and we just, you know, we're like, we almost get obsessed trying to figure out why. And some of you know that, well, I'll just share a little story. Some of you know that when Sheldon went missing down at Cheney, for some reason, I don't know, I seen it on Facebook and I called some people. I think I called Sanford. I don't see him here tonight. And I was like, do you guys need help looking? And he said, yeah, come on down. So I jumped in the truck. It was like 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. It was cold. I went down there, and Cheney has like 67 miles of of shore, something like that. You can correct me if I'm wrong. 50 to 67 miles of shoreline. And, you know, we didn't know where to start looking. And we just, we had like one, well, the police had one boat in the water, and we had Doug and Phil Utsi had a boat in the water. So it was like two boats in the water in this big lake, and we had like 13 or 14 people. And we were like, well, let's just walk along the shore and see if we can't, you know, find something. And so we did, and just, you know, just leave. There was a lot of people praying, and Levi told us where to go, and me and Jason Graber were together searching, and we weren't, you know, we were maybe searching for 30 to 40 minutes, and we found his canoe, which was, you know, in 67 miles of shoreline, you just don't stumble on a canoe, I don't think, but we found his canoe in just 30 minutes of searching. And of course, we did cry out to God. Everybody in the search party, I think, was crying out to God, either in their minds, or then, you know, we used to have some time of prayer or two. And it was just, yeah, it was just, if, you know, if God, if you can just have Sheldon safe somewhere. I mean, that was the plea. And of course, later in the night, things did not go, you know, we didn't find Sheldon safe, but we did find Sheldon. And you know, some of us, you know, not everybody, I didn't dwell on it just too long, but I did question God. Why did you let him die out there in the middle of that lake? And you can come almost obsessed with it, asking God why. And in the end, you know, he's God. He doesn't have to answer to me or to anyone else. That's just the fact of life. And yeah, it was an experience like none other I've ever had before. Being out there and searching for him and just crying out to God to help us. And I think he did help us in actually finding the canoe and the body, but it wasn't the results that we expected. So so what are some other, yeah, so I like Ollie's thoughts here, but what are some other ways that what if someone comes up to you on the street and says, What's the correct way to view God? Of course, we can't put the total correct way to view God because it's hard to put your fingers around it. But what would be something you would tell them? How do you, as a Christian, view God? Go ahead, David. Yeah, go ahead, Marvin. Isn't it neat how just about any answer that you would give would be a right, you know, a right answer. I mean, not anything good about God or any attribute of God would be a right answer. So that's why, you know, I like hearing what people's response would be. But yeah, go ahead, Elizabeth. Because God's love comes out, you know, that God's love comes out in us. So we're representing the, yeah, we're representing God if we're his friend, right? If we're his believer. So it's kind of sobering at the same time. Yeah, go ahead. The other verse I had to think of when I thought about the proper view of God is this verse about being still and knowing and know that I am God. I don't do a very good job at this person. I mean, I don't think I do a very good job of doing this personally. It's kind of hard to being still, kind of hard to be quiet, totally quiet before God and let him speak into our lives. Is that what this verse means, or is that what you guys take away from this verse? Go ahead, Nathan.
I think it's easier for us to think that we still have some strength when we're doing something. But if we, knowing that God is God, is recognizing that we don't have any strength. And back to your earlier question,
go ahead, Ollie. Yeah, go ahead, David.
You asked what does it mean to be still and know that I am God. I think you can put your finger on one of those same things, God, that
Very good. Go ahead, Lowell.
You may have alluded to this or mentioned this, but I think we need to explain exactly what God was doing in the brother's life when his farm burned down, whatever the situation is. We make ourselves, make God incredibly small and ourselves incredibly big. I think it's appropriate if our farm burns down to say, well, God showed me that I had too much affection there or something like that. But when we take his position and assign motives to what he did, as it were for everybody else, we make him very small.
Because all you got to do is go on Google and ask, right? You know? Today we got to know everything. You know, we want to know everything. But of course, I think that happens in every generation or every age. They want to know, you know, some certain parts of the society wants to or thinks they have everything figured out. You know, there's nothing that can't be explained. Yeah, very good. I think we're going to draw this to a close unless someone else has something burning else that they want to really share. Okay, I'd like to read just a couple of verses yet. To the Lord confides in those who fear him. This is from Psalms 25, verse 14. The Lord confides in those who fear him. He makes his covenant known to them. And then in Deuteronomy 31, verse 6, we have, be strong and courageous, do not be afraid or terrified, because the Lord of God goes with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Thanks for everybody that helped share. And I hope that some of you maybe were encouraged, because I know I was when I was studying this. I don't know if they have this in the library or not, but I would really encourage people to read this book. It's a real easy, simple read. It's Tozer, The Knowledge of the Holy. I'm actually going to do the prayer time now. I would welcome your prayer request after I give one request. It was suggested that we might spend a little bit of time with our other prayer requests, praying on the 18th. If you weren't here on Sunday, on the 18th, Hands of Christ and the Rise Kids Church, we're having we're going to have a program, we're going to have some food for the people that come, and we're going to have a program with some singing by the Rise Kids and also a play, I think, of Easter, and then we're going to have some special singing, and then we're also going to share the Easter story. Just praying for that God would have his way in Hutchison and especially in this in the people that come to the Easter celebration and celebrate with us, that that God would touch lives that he wants to touch. And so just having some special prayer for that. But I do welcome any other prayer requests that you might have.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, if these are all the requests, I'll read over them again. And we're going to spend about 5 minutes in prayer then. So we have Hands of Christ and Rise service at the fairgrounds. And we have Matthew Schrock, which is David L.'s son-in-law, right? Prostate cancer is recovering good. And then we have Daryl and Karen, as they are in Turkey. And Matt and Andrea, did they leave already, or they're going to leave next week? Is that right, Matt? When do you leave? 12th of April, so coming up. And then we have the ministers' meetings and the volunteers next week. So let's spend 5 minutes in prayer, and then Shane, do you have like one verse of chorus you could sing to close it? So let's just gather in small groups and pray.